Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And you know, in the Milton Bradley board game, Life, you get a job, you get some security, and then you can have a child. But in reality...
My name's Stephanie. I'm calling from Fort Worth, and I had an employer that insisted on me working 70 hours a week through tax season, and then after the baby was born, fired me promptly.
My name is Sharon Green. I'm calling from Wareham, Massachusetts. I worked for Physician Sales and Service at the time. 5 hours after delivering my son, my boss called me to ask me some purchasing questions. He knew how committed I was to the job, so he really shouldn't have called, but he did. And 3 days later, me and the baby were back at work with a bassinet in my office.
Yeah, that's no game. Kids are cute, but just not apparently to some employers. More from you on this subject and some others a little later on this hour. We'll also have an update from Mexico and Ukraine. We'll hear about the Christmas tree harvest this year. Hint, the energy from all those burned up trees will power a lot of lights come January. This being the season of goodwill, we'd love to know how big your tree is this year and how much it cost. Also, another look at income inequality and a modest proposal for narrowing it from Nobel economist Robert Shiller. But first, today, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear Young versus United Parcel Service. Peggy Young, a UPS driver who sued the company under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, a law passed by Congress in 1978. When Young became pregnant, her doctor advised her, as most women are advised, not to lift more than 20 pounds. Young asked for a light-duty assignment under a program UPS had in place for other workers, but the request was denied. At just 14 weeks pregnant and unwilling to disregard her doctor's orders, Young took leave without pay for the next 6 months. She also lost her medical coverage before having her baby. Now she's suing to get back pay along with a recommendation that her rights were violated under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. Pregnancy, of course, is completely normal, and employers are required to make reasonable accommodations for other workers with physical conditions under laws like the Americans with Disabilities Act. Yet many employers seem to consider pregnancy an imposition or bringing a baby to work to be something like showing up with a disruptive Great Dane, an unwelcome distraction. Is this case about outmoded gender notions or about the rights of businesses to set their own rules on their own property? Jillian Thomas is an attorney and author of the forthcoming book, Because of Sex. She says this case may be a hard one for the court to work through.
In the pregnancy context, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act has a clause that requires that employers treat pregnant women who need accommodation the same way that they treat employees who are similar in their ability or inability to work. And so employers have sort of fumbled with this requirement. It's not as clear as the requirement under the ADA.
No.
Yeah. And the issue that has been brought forward by this case is what exactly is a worker who is similar to a pregnant worker. So in the case of Peggy Young, the case that's before the Supreme Court, UPS, her employer, did make accommodations under its policies for three different categories of workers, none of which it found included pregnant women.
And in this case, why isn't it as simple as you bring an excuse from your doctor that says you can't lift more than 20 pounds and that's the end of it?
Well, I think employers consider it a cost issue, or they certainly cite the potential burden on other employees. And I think that that is a human concern. I think most people have had the experience of being in a workplace and feeling in one way or another that they're being asked to, quote unquote, pick up the slack for someone else. I think that's really a fundamental framing of the workplace as a place where the ideal worker is the only kind who's welcome, one who's able to come in at 9, leave at 5, never needs to take time off for kids, never has a need for their workspace or their work hours to be altered in any way. And employers view any deviation from that, whether it's people with caregiving responsibilities or physical impairments, view that as burdensome. It's ironic, though, that employers say that, because the data is legion that providing accommodations to workers and making it possible for workers to stay on the job in whatever form actually increases retention, reduces turnover, increases morale, And a coalition of business organizations did submit a friend of the court brief in this case to the court, explaining it's not that difficult to make accommodations. In virtually every workplace, there are tasks or projects or things that have always needed doing that could be done by folks who need accommodation.
I remember in the original Americans with Disabilities Act, writing of that legislation, which I think is flawed legislation in many ways, there was this concern that, oh, gosh, it would open a whole can of worms. And if some people were granted certain accommodations, then everyone would want them. And we have seen a proliferation of people who have disability stickers running around and using parking spaces that they really aren't appropriate for. But in the case of pregnancy, that's not going to apply. I mean, I can't sort of pretend that I'm pregnant to get some sort of co-worker's benefit here. So I just wonder why the court would take the employer's view that everyone has to be normal so seriously in this law.
I think what we're running up against in this case are stereotypes about pregnant women that are deep-seated and go beyond the physical repercussions of pregnancy. And the notion that having a child makes you a less committed worker, both in terms of your commitment to putting in the hours and your commitment to staying in the workplace for many, many years. So I think that what we're up against is these deep-seated predispositions and stereotypes, which the Pregnancy Discrimination Act was passed to eradicate and which still persist. But the reality is that 85% of women are going to be pregnant at some point in their working lives and probably more than once. Women experience a vast array of physical complications from pregnancy, even in a quote-unquote healthy pregnancy, that are going to be interfering with job responsibilities, especially as you see more women moving into male-dominated fields, policing, construction, law enforcement, firefighting. So it's a conflict between stereotypes that we have about mothers and their abilities and the reality of a physical event that is major and that most women are going to experience.
You know, these stereotypes that you talk about, I mean, they're really deep-seated. I mean, we're talking about employers trying to maintain a fiction of the ideal worker that really goes back to medieval times when there were huge pools of workers that you could just sort of use. And if somebody, you know, lost their hand, you basically say goodbye and you just take the next person who's standing in line. It seems to me that in the modern workplace, focusing on the individual aspects and attributes of each worker is a good strategy, whether they're pregnant, whether they have a certain disability. I mean, certainly management goes out of its way to give special parking spaces to, you know, different people, depending on whether they're a vice president or a director. It just seems like the whole doctrine is based on a fiction that eventually is going to collapse of its own weight.
I think that that's a great service that the Americans with Disabilities Act did for us, and an important cultural shift that it started in terms of making people realize that it's a very rare person who goes through their entire working life without some sort of adverse event, and some of those events are permanent and some of them are temporary. But helping employers and people understand that as human beings, we come into the workplace with family relationships, health issues, things that are going to interfere necessarily. And I think that thinking and that shift needs to occur with pregnancy. And we need to reconcile this notion that people are automatons coming into the workplace.
Exactly. This is a philosophical question. The idea that, you know, we're going to pretend that people don't have caregiving responsibilities. We're going to pretend that people don't get pregnant. We're going to pretend that people don't have differing abilities, whether we're talking about disability or just differing abilities. And yet, you know, someone has a ski accident and they come in on crutches and everything's fine. But pregnancy is viewed as some sort of huge issue that has to be dealt with. Is there a complication in the law in the sense that when corporations are viewed as people in, say, the Hobby Lobby case, for instance, where corporations have the right to dictate certain sort of ideological questions, religious questions on the workplace, does this complicate how this gets dealt with by the court, because they're going to give a lot of latitude to the corporation because it's viewed as a person with the same standing as a worker?
Yeah, would that women got the same degree of indulgence and sympathy that the owners of Hobby Lobby did with respect to their beliefs about contraception. I think that's a very real concern. I mean, I think that the best hope that the litigants have in this case, the petitioner Ms. Young and her lawyers and advocates supporting her, I think the best chance that they have is to focus the court on the legislative history of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which was passed 36 years ago. Its promise has never been fulfilled. And to look at the circumstances that surrounded the passage of that law, which, by the way, came out of a Supreme Court decision very similar to the lower court's reasoning in the Young case, and to look at what was the purpose of this law and what are the continuing effects of pregnancy discrimination? What are the real-world impacts? And for all of this court's flaws and blinders about real people's lives, they do tend to, obviously with exceptions, but they do tend to notice and understand real-world impacts. And if the outcome of this case is really going to be that you have pregnant women in a vast range of jobs needing a temporary kinds of accommodations, and we're saying that they're not entitled to those, and yet vastly expanding swaths of people who qualify as disabled under the Americans with Disabilities Act do get them, then where are we left and where have we come in 36 years?
Jillian Thomas, attorney and author of the upcoming book, Because of Sex. Thanks so much. Lots to think about in this case, and it goes way beyond pregnancy, that's for sure.
Thanks for having me.
It seems morning TV is always trying to help us all out with our marriages, keeping us together. George and Robin Roberts help us. Al Roker, forget the weather. Am I going to stay married? Good Morning America to the rescue.
With the divorce rate at 50% and climbing, maybe we should all read this essay written by two relationship therapists who proclaim it's conscious uncoupling that prevents families from being broken by divorce.
The conscious uncoupling of Gwyneth Paltrow. It sounds like a Milan Kundera novel. The whole divorce is inevitable notion is a complete myth, you know. Fiction. Divorce has been on the decline for the last 30 years. If you got married in the 90s, folks, you have a high chance of staying together. Surely the influence of all that Dr. Dre, Radiohead, Green Day, and Guns N' Roses. So what we played at my wedding, 1995, folks. It's a big party. You should have been there. Justin Wolfers probably has a different theory about all this, though. He's professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan and a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Justin Wolfers, welcome to The Takeaway.
John, it's great to be here.
So I saw these numbers on the New York Times. It came off the most emailed list where it quickly rose to the top with a bullet, as you might expect. Where do these numbers come from?
So there's a bunch of different ways of measuring divorce. The first thing is anytime someone gets divorced, there's a divorce certificate on file at the county courthouse. And so you could count all the divorce certificates. And there's a lot fewer divorce certificates being issued today than there were 30 years ago. Another thing you can do is interview people and ask them about their marital histories. You know, when did you get married? When did you get divorced? And from that, we can figure out how many people got divorced each year. That also tells us the divorce rate's been declining for 30 years.
And the peak was in the 80s?
Peak was, depending how which data source you look at it, you know, 79, 80, 81, sometime around then.
And do you have a sort of weighted average on what is the, you know, is it a magic 7 or 14-year itch or 20 is a tough year? Because, you know, there's an argument to be made that the people who got married in the 90s, it may be a little early yet to be claiming that they're together for all time.
Yeah, you should always be a little worried about some of the stories, indeed myths you hear about things like a 7-year itch. Marriages are actually most likely to break up soon after they form. So the first 2 years are actually the most likely to result in separation. And then the chances of divorce decline every year that you remain married after that. So, John, you've survived since 95. I'd say you're looking pretty good, mate.
I'm looking pretty good, yeah. And in those first couple of years, that's the well-known Kardashian effect, right?
Yeah. You know, sometimes you wake up, you discover you made a mistake. Sometimes you grow up, you discover that you made a mistake. But people are doing less of that now. I think part of the story is, in fact, people are waiting longer to get married. You know, back in the days when you were getting married at 19, 20, 21, it's impossible to believe that you'd be able to figure out the right partner for who you were going to be when you grew up. you know, in your 40s and 50s. Today, people are delaying marriage to their mid to late 20s, often in their 30s. And we're seeing a lot more stable marriages as a result.
Is there any aspect of this that there's a disincentive to get divorced, that people who have gotten divorced find themselves miserable, unlike Louis C.K., who finds apparent happiness in divorce, being free? I mean, is there a case of where divorces really do fall apart, where the idea of splitting up actually becomes a very dreadful idea in the out years?
The way it works is the year that people get divorced is often one of the least happy of their lives. So a lot of people look at that and they say, well, therefore, divorce must be a bad thing if it makes people unhappy. But what you see actually is that, you know, when you get married, you're really happy. Happiness tends to decline a bit as the marriage continues. And among those people who do get divorced, you see their happiness declining right up to the point of divorce. And then in the years after, actually, their happiness recovers, suggesting, you know, maybe this is a good choice for the people who go ahead and make it, that life, in fact, does get better, even if it doesn't feel that way when you're in the middle of it.
So why does the, I mean, I guess, you know, everybody loves to say that the media distorts everything and keeps myths around that need to go away. But why do you think there is this, you know, gut level sense that you're rolling the dice when you get married, even though the statistics say, no, in fact, you're much more likely to stay together. You shouldn't worry so much.
Well, you know, by many measures, there's still a reasonable chance that many people will end up divorced. You know, maybe it's closer to 1 in 3 than it is to 1 in 2. That's still enough to worry a lot of people. But, you know, marriage and divorce is one of those incredibly politically contentious issues. And so I think, you know, advocates on both sides who want to argue that the sky is falling in order to bring greater attention to how they want to reinvent families and marriage, I have a great incentive to make us think that this institution is declining. It's not declining, but it is definitely adapting. Marriage today is very different to what marriage meant 30, 40 years ago.
And there's an even broader study to be done here, in the sense that the kinds of relationships that are stable and that constitute a, you know, what we would have called back in the 50s a nuclear family, they're becoming more diverse. I mean, there's people who are gay, who are straight, who are married. There are people who are not married but who are together. There are, you know, adoptive families that have all kinds of different, you know, non-sacred sorts of bonds to them that have grown up with this statistic of declining divorces. Yes?
Absolutely. So American family life looks a lot more varied than it once did. But even among those who in the statistics look like traditional nuclear families, you know, mum and dad and two kids, their family life is very different today. You know, in the 1950s and 60s, you know, dad's job was to go to work and mum's was to stay at home. In that sort of a marriage where people were operating in completely separate spheres, there was very much an opposites attract marriage. You know, mum wanted to find the best wage earner she could find and dad wanted to find the best homemaker he could find, and they didn't necessarily have a lot in common. What we've seen, though, is as marriage has changed and women have moved into the workforce and more opportunities have opened up, is marriage has adapted. Marriage today is very much less about mum and dad playing different and specialized roles. Instead, it's about shared passions. You know, an economist would call it consumption complementarities, and someone a bit more romantic would call it love. You know, the soulmate marriage is a very recent thing. And that's, you know, today when you see nuclear families like that, it's very different than their parents or their grandparents who were together for quite different reasons.
And what kind of kids come out of that before we go?
You know, I think that's very much an open question. You know,
yeah,
we
yeah,
can
yeah,
see...
Yeah, yeah. Professor dodging changing. The question. That's an open
that's
question.
That's exactly what I'm
it's
doing,
an open
mate.
Question as you're dodging me. Okay, so are you married?
I have been with my partner for many, many years, but we are not formally married.
Many, many years? Does she know the actual number? Or he?
Even I know the actual number, mate. It's 17.
All right. Justin Wolfers, thanks so much. Professor of Economics and Public Policy at the University of Michigan and Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Here's a seasonal statistic. Last year, Americans bought a little more than 33 million trees at a total cost of $1.16 billion. Those are Christmas trees, spending on average $35.30 for real Christmas trees, not fake plastic trees. So, Mary Jean Packer?
Yes.
How big of a chunk of that $1.16 billion did the people you represent get?
Well, New York State's tree farms number over 850. Last year, almost 300,000 trees were cut on Christmas tree farms in New York State.
Nice. Mary Jean Packer is executive director of the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York. And where are you right now?
I'm at the Elms Family Tree Farm in Ballston Spa, New York.
Get out. There's an Elms Family Tree Farm.
And what makes it worse, my name is Chip.
That does make it worse. Yeah. Chip Elms. So you're in the tree game there, Chip, huh?
Well, that's right. We say elms make great Christmas trees.
Well, elms don't make great Christmas trees, but yours do. What kind of trees do you typically sell? Is it the spruce or are you doing the firs?
We do have some spruce, but we grow mostly Fraser and balsam fir.
That's great. Mary Jean Packer, there are all kinds of farms in the state of New York. A lot send their trees around the world even, yes?
Well, about half of the tree farms here in New York are like Chip's and focus on choose and cut, but quite a few others also offer wholesale trees, and they're sold in markets certainly all over the U.S., and most of our trees that go overseas go as part of the national initiative called Trees for Troops.
And that sends Christmas trees to military bases?
Yes, they go to about 36 military bases around the country, some overseas. And matter of fact, this today, FedEx will be picking up over 100 trees donated from 16 local farms and nurseries to provide for families whose spouses are on active duty in the military.
Well, that's a great sense of home for people who are as far from home as they can get. There's also the added advantage, I think. It's not really a very Christmassy thought, though, Chip, but imagine how irritating it would be to those ISIS people to see a Christmas tree, you know, over the hill, right, in Iraq.
Well, I hadn't really thought of that, but the comments we get from the families are a Christmas tree feels and smells like home. So we feel it's a small part that we do to show our support to the soldiers who are working hard to give us the freedoms that we have.
Best way to cut down a tree, slant or a straight cut?
Well, a slight slant so that it doesn't fall on top of you.
Mary Jean Packer, what about a stand? Do you recommend the smaller stands or those big, huge plate steel stands that they're selling these days?
I recommend the stand that'll hold the most possible water. The biggest thing that I tell people who are choosing a farm fresh tree, if they want to keep it that fresh, they need to keep water on it.
Well, it certainly was a privilege to speak on this Christmas tree harvesting season day in the beginning of December with Chip Elms. I have to say that's a milestone for me in radio. Chip, you get good business this year, and I hope the slush turns to some nice powdery snow for you up there.
You know, day before Thanksgiving, we had about 10 inches of snow, and it was just gorgeous. I put those pictures up on Facebook, and thousands of people saw them, and we had a lot of nice comments. So it's nothing like a Christmas tree field with a light dusting of snow.
Great. All right. Well, the best of the holidays to you. And Mary Jean Packer, thanks so much.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Great to speak with you.
Mary Jean Packer is the executive director of Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York. And we want you to head over to thetakeaway.org. We want to know where you are, how big your tree is, and how much it costs. Kind of an economic indicator, the Takeaway Tree Index. Be a data point with us at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
There may be a political breaking point looming in Mexico. A celebrated disappearance of 43 college students last seen in late September in the city of Iguala has focused national criticism against the government of President Enrique Peña Nieto. His approval ratings have plunged to 39%, the lowest of any Mexican president since the mid-1990s. Can he hang on after the drug cartels have showed they can even order elected officials to kidnap their own citizens? Will Grant, the BBC's Mexico and Central America correspondent, says angry protests have become national and happen every night in the capital.
After a night of clashes in Mexico City, the inevitable cleanup is underway. Glaziers are refitting shop fronts which were destroyed by the more radical protesters.
So this is Reforma Avenue, one of the longest and most important thoroughfares in Mexico City. As I look around me at the moment, all of the shop fronts along this particular stretch of Reforma are damaged. There are police outside one particular bank that's got a broken window. There is a FedEx that's boarded up, an Avis car rental firm that's boarded up. Further down, there is a destroyed front of a Starbucks. And just looking over the road, somebody has sprayed the words Fuera Peña, meaning Peña out.
I think they overstepped the mark. It's good to protest, but with respect to everyone, beyond wanting the president to leave, I want him to sort out the problems.
I don't think the damage is justifiable. Instead, I think it would be better to wait for an answer from the government that's backed with actions. I don't think the violence is the solution to our problems, as it's specifically against the violence that we are protesting, and so to generate more violence is counterproductive.
This is now, without doubt, Mr. Peña Nieto's biggest political challenge since he came to office 2 years ago. So far, the response to the crisis has been seen as inadequate by many Mexicans, and Mr. Peña Nieto is facing his lowest popularity rating since he took power. His government has now presented to Congress for debate a 10-point plan aimed at reforming the police. Some of the more controversial measures, such as replacing the country's 1,800 municipal police forces with 32 state-level organizations, involve constitutional changes and may take until the new year to be approved. For now, though, the president is probably simply hoping for a period of respite from the calls for his resignation.
The BBC's Mexico and Central America correspondent, Will Grant, in Mexico City. A few more words on this subject. Ricardo Perez is a Mexican-American who grew up in Guerrero, but he has lived in the U.S. for 10 years, and he says as he has intently watched tragic events unfolding in his nation, he finds himself torn between his fear of his own homeland and his hope for its brighter future.
I see a lot of the same, meaning everyone is just tired. It's just been like way too many decades, you know, of the same thing happening over and over. And I think that what this situation with the students has bring to us, it's just like the drop that made it too much, you know. So you can see it on the people's faces, the desperation, the feeling of not feeling safe on the public transportation. You just hear, you know, the stories of people, you know, being robbed by the cops or this or that. And at the same time, to be honest with you, you hear people who have it really good, you know, who have their business, who just want to work and go back home and don't think about politics and don't think about anything that's happening. You really hear a lot of voices down there. But I think that nowadays, the predominant voice is that we want a change, that we want a government that works for the people that live there.
What would cause you to go down there? What would you see on television or what would motivate you to join? What would it have to get to?
Well, I think it's important to know that in one way or another, I feel a part of it already just because I was born in Mexico and because I am Mexican. And I see that that's the sentiment of people. This is the people just wanting a better future for their country. Our country has been going down the drain for now almost, it seems like, 70 years. So we're fed up. We're tired. We want to change. And I personally think that I will be ready to go down there as soon as the guy on the chair leaves right now.
In your story, you've told about many occasions when you were younger and you feared the situation around you, and you had to watch your back and realize that when you came to the United States, that was something you didn't necessarily have to do. Is this sense of vigilance, of having to watch out for your own safety, a jacket that you can put on and take off when you cross the border into Mexico?
I've been living in this country for 10 years, and it is not like a jacket, because trauma, you cannot take it off and put it back on. People that live down there, it's a part of their life that they might get robbed in a bus. It's a part of their life that their car might get stolen. It's a part of their life that you get a phone call extortioning you. And that is not okay, and that is what the U.S. has taught me so far. It has taught me that if there is something that is not fair, if there is something that it's wrong, if someone that doesn't deserve to be heard, it's getting heard over and over again, you should raise your voice and you should say, this is enough and this is not fair. So the fact that you are guaranteed safety, that is a very big difference. And it's not easy to understand what that really means in full until you experience it.
I guess the catchword is, we're tired of this situation, but you don't sound tired. You sound enthusiastic and very hopeful about a possible political change down in Mexico. Is that fair?
Exactly. It's exciting. It's we're fed up, but you see, through negatives, we're going to reach through the positive. Through identifying the things that we do not want, we're going to reach that understanding of the things that we do want as a people of Mexico.
Ricardo Perez is a Mexican-American who grew up in Guerrero, Mexico, and has lived in the United States for 10 years, watching very intently at what's going on in Mexico right now. Ricardo, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Income inequality that we've been talking about on this program all week is a central focus of the most esoteric of economics right now. You might be saying, well, it's about time, but seriously, income inequality was for a long time difficult to measure compared to growth and employment. But many economists, including the French bombshell theorist Thomas Piketty, believe that inequality is an engine that drives economic inefficiency and may be able to predict an entire economy's downfall. Today, our inequality conversation brings Robert Shiller to us. He's a Yale economist and a recipient of the Nobel Prize. Shiller has been working on this problem for more than a decade. Getting the right handles and measures on inequality, he says, could be the key to dealing with a lot of thorny economic problems that have so far eluded politicians.
So the idea that I put forth was that we don't know what inequality is going to be in the future. Maybe it'll improve on its own. We don't have to do anything. But what if it gets worse? We should have a contingency plan. And that form that I would make that plan is an indexation system that automatically raises taxes on the rich if they get really richer. And that's a simple solution that would set in motion a process that would at least reduce extremes of inequality that might come in the future.
If this were to actually be implemented and there would be a widespread notion that taxes go up if inequality goes up, I wonder if the converse would provide an incentive, that if employers who are at the top end of incomes gave raises and bonuses to their workers, that collectively that would contribute to a sense of, well, if those at the bottom have rising incomes, I'm going to get lower taxes.
Well, okay, I guess that's right. See, the thing that I thought would happen if we had inequality indexation is that people would be more tolerant of pro-growth policies that might seem to be opposed today because they might create inequality. But if we have a system in place that guarantees that inequality can't get a lot worse, then we might as a country be more aggressive in pro-growth policies. And that might ultimately work out to the best thing. Policies that encourage entrepreneurship and get people going on individual businesses might be more palatable if we had a system that guaranteed against worsening inequality.
And do you think we could actually get to the point where people on the upper income scale, the so-called 1%, would actually see that it's in their benefit because their taxes would come down, that this prosperity is shared at lower levels, either with entrepreneurs or raises on the industrial class or in the service sector, that kind of thing?
Well, that's what we want to see. I think actually those people in the top 1% who would fight any efforts to make a less unequal society are making a mistake already, because it's not in their interest to be in a highly unequal society. And I think that this is something that will appeal. This kind of thing ought to appeal to wealthy people as well. It's just not the way we want to live. Do you want to live in a gated community with billionaires around you and fearing for the anger of the general common people? That's no fun. It's not the way anyone should want to live. It's just not great to be an isolated, super rich person. You start to be fearful of everyone else. You're fearful of kidnappers or whatever. And so much of the pleasure of living is just being with other people and sharing things. So I don't think that it's really against the interest of rich people at all to impose some limit. Now, incidentally, I am not opposed to inequality. And fairness dictates that there should be some inequality. Someone who worked a lifetime to build a fortune, and if that's what this person wants, that person should not be, see it all, just taken away. It's only fair that they should keep a good part of it. But I think that there's some limits on inequality. We don't want it to go too far. And we want to keep a spirit of community and shared values in our society.
How do you think the new GOP Congress might respond to proposals that you've made continually? Do you think they'd be more likely to listen to you? Are you more enthusiastic about maybe coming before Congress again in the next term?
But the real problem that I think Republicans are very sensitive to, I said this already, but it just isn't fair to take someone who's been working 12 hours a day in a building a business for a lifetime and has the hope of, say, you know, doing something with that money that's meaningful to them. It's just not fair to take it all away. That's why I have a proposal that we should get into more risk management institutions, like preventing an inequality from developing in the future that is just gratuitous and unrelated to people's efforts. And I'm worried that that could happen because we've seen inequality get worse already. And it's not because the wealth, higher income people are trying harder. It doesn't appear to be. It's because of some economic forces. It's a fully Republican proposal to take insurance measures against worsening inequality.
Robert Shiller, Nobel economist and Yale professor, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The radical idea of insuring yourself against lower income in later life, insurance as a solution to taxation and all of the problems that they argue about in Congress. Tomorrow, the inequality discussion we see around the world in wealth will see mirrored in a severe imbalance in mapping and census data around the world. Some places are mapped and measured down to the square inch. Others have no idea of who the poor are, or where they live, or even the size of their community. Some nations are data poor, and it is a huge problem in trying to correct economic injustices. Addressing inequality, your thoughts?
This is Sean from San Antonio, and the answer is plain and simple, major tax reform. The middle class is not rich enough to get the tax breaks that they are getting, and neither poor enough to get the government benefits they are receiving. It's just a problem that has been occurring, and the middle class is always being passed up by politicians who promise many things but do not go forth on their promise.
This is Rob from Florida. I think there's a misconception that most people think rich people or wealthy people just had things given to them. My family is fairly well-to-do, and we've worked for every penny, and our friends have worked very hard for what they've gotten.
From Orlando, Florida, minimum wage is the first step. Inflation has ballooned since the 1970s, yet the American paycheck has not. From Monroe, North Carolina, provide free secondary education in exchange for some form of public or civil service term.
This is Charles in Everett, Washington. As to the disparity between haves and have-nots, we're simply witnessing the abject failure of a 34-year experiment, a rather brutal one, in trickle-down economics. Supply-side economics, along with the dismantling of any meaningful campaign finance laws, has rendered our democracy an oligarchy. Just that simple.
Philomena from Westchester. I think the only thing we can do is continue to point out and expose and address and talk about the disparity between those that have and those that have not. To leave it unsaid is a dangerous path.
And from Grand Prairie, Texas, the larger the gap, the less sustainable the system. Sooner or later, it will collapse on itself, no matter what measures we take to improve fairness. We've seen it over and over again in civilization throughout history. Lots to say there, lots to talk about in our discussion on income inequality will continue all week long. Share your ideas. Before we go, a reminder, we're making a Christmas tree list, and we're checking it twice at thetakeaway.org. We want to know where you are, how big your tree is, how much it costs, the Takeaway Tree Index. You can be a data point at thetakeaway.org. You can call us, too, at 8778-MYTAKE or tweet at The Takeaway. Scots Pine, Norwegian Spruce, one's made of plastic, a fir. We want to know about them all. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Won't that Takeaway Christmas tree map of the United States look so beautiful on your mantelpiece? This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.